Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and this week we are looking at the big winners of COVID. I am going to be speaking to Richard Brooks, who's been writing the Prophets of Doom pieces in the magazine over the last several issues, all about the companies whose profits have suddenly mushroomed extraordinarily over the last 18 months due to one cause principally, and that is sloppiness in working out how you're actually going to pay the people and desperation from the government who needed to throw money at something very quickly in order to secure tests and PPE. He's going to be taking us through exactly how that procurement process has been done and bungled. And later on, we will also be speaking to Solomon Hughes, who is going to be at the other end of the COVID supply chain. Solomon has been writing about the MUC fraud. MUC stands for Mini Umbrella Companies. It's a fascinating way that firms have been manipulating official and proper loopholes in order to make a bit of money on the side. And it's the workers themselves at these firms who spotted it and got in touch with the Eye about it. But first, Prophets of Doom. Richard Brooks has been writing about a lot of the companies which have been making enormous amounts of money over the last 18 months, whether that's through PPE, providing test and trace services, various other things associated with COVID-19. And these companies have seen their profits rise enormously, exponentially in some cases, which has led to a lot of questions about whether the money, almost all of which has come obviously from the government, has been spent in a reasonable or a cost-effective way. I started off by asking Richard what made him look at this in the first place. Here he is.
When companies that have been winning all these PPE contracts started filing accounts, some of them that is, we started looking at them, see if there were any patterns, how much money were they making? You know, it's pretty obvious that some of the big companies that were already in this kind of business were drastically increasing their profits on the back of it. Companies like Uniserv, one of the big freight companies, increased its profits by about sevenfold, from 6.3 million to 46.4 million in a very short period, just covering the first 3 months of the pandemic. You know, their owner took out a £20 million dividend. You know, that's what you could do pretty quickly. There are lots of other companies. Randox Laboratories, which you might remember was advised by Tory MP Owen Paterson, sponsored the Cheltenham Festival and so on, pretty well connected. Its profits multiplied about fourfold. You know, so of course they were going to get busier in the pandemic, but did we really need to pay them so much, multiply their profits, maybe give them a bit more? But, you know, it does suggest something wrong with the procurements. And, you know, it's not just them, but I mean, the smaller companies, what we can see of those smaller companies that kind of hit the headlines, companies like Ayanda Capital, which had nothing to do with PPE, but was owned by Tim Horlick, who's the husband of the famous fund manager, Nicola Horlick, and advised by Andrew Mills, who was a Department of International Trade advisor. It's just filed accounts showing that it made, Ayanda Capital made 20 million on supplying PPE in a very short period of time. And that is before the commissions to Andrew Mills. We don't know what that was. That one sort of, on the one hand, shows the riches there were to be made in a very short space of time. On the other, contains all that secrecy that stops us knowing exactly what those riches, you know, there are many like that. PPE MedPro, which was formed in May last year, it immediately won £200 million worth of contracts, but it won't have to file accounts for months. And even when it does, it probably won't have to declare its income and profits because it'll be a small company. And to top it all, we don't have a clue who's behind the company. Its ownership's hidden behind an Island Man Trust, run by an Island Man Trust service company provider, which specializes in keeping people's money secret. You know, maybe okay for private fortunes, but perhaps not what we want for £200 million worth of taxpayers' money during a pandemic. So we need a lot more openness on some of these. The evidence we do have shows that extraordinary profits were there to be had, yet we don't have anything like all the information we should. I would say we have less than half the information we should.
Is there ever an issue with companies that are based overseas that are receiving business from the government which don't have to file accounts in the same way?
That's a big issue. The biggest COVID contract recipient of all, Inova Medical Group Inc., based overseas. That's an American company registered in Las Vegas, Nevada, so it doesn't have to file accounts. We just can't see what it's made.
You can see the money leaving the government, yeah. But you can't see it. Yeah. You can't see the profits, and you can't tell exactly how much has been made and how much, you know, what the expenses are at the other end, and whether this might represent value for money if the costs have gone up enormously, or if actually all the extra spending is then going straight to the directors or whoever it may be.
That's right, and exactly where you are on that spectrum, which is pretty important. You can ask till you're blue in the face. You know, I've asked the company, the government, you know, what did it do for this? How many tests did it supply? What cost did it pay? And so on. And no one will tell you. It's either commercially confidential or, you know, some other excuse. But it's interesting that they're both government and companies are hiding behind the normal rules of the market. You know, the market does depend on a bit of on commercial confidentiality to work. That's a legitimate concern. But the whole point of COVID procurement was that there was no market. This wasn't a competition. Contracts were handed out without competition. So, you know, the commercial sensitivity excuse really shouldn't be, you know, work in this situation.
It sounds like you're saying that the companies are hiding it because they don't want to publicise exactly what swingingly huge profits they've made, and the governments don't want to publicise it because they don't want to point out that they just threw a lot of money at the wall.
Exactly.
In the early days of the pandemic. Yeah.
I mean, who would benefit from this information coming out? Oh, just the taxpayer. Well, what do they matter?
So for anyone not involved in business, how would this work? How do these enormous profits suddenly come about?
So, you know, imagine you are a shoe wholesaler, right? And let's say you buy a pair of shoes from a Chinese manufacturer for £5 per pair, and you sell them to retailers in the UK for £10 a pair, right? Let's say in a year, you buy and sell 1 million pairs of shoes, right? You're pretty busy. That would mean that your income would be £10 million, and your costs of buying those shoes would be £5 million. So you would have a gross profit of £5 million. But you would also have costs of your own premises in the UK, of shipping the goods from China, of your sales staff, your admin staff, and so on. And that would be quite a bit. So that, let's say that came to £4 million. So you, out of your original sales of £10 million, you will be left with a profit of £1 million. Now, let's say that a new customer came to you and said, right, I want to buy 10 million pairs of shoes. You can still buy them at £5 a pair. I want to buy 10 million pairs of shoes from you. And you don't have to ship them. I'll buy them from you in China, on the dock in China. I'll ship them to the UK. I'll provide them to the, you know, I'll get them to the retailers and so on. So your only costs are the £5 a pair buying the shoes. So on that 10 million shoes, you then make 100 million income of 50 million costs. You make a £50 million profit in the space of a few weeks, because they want these things very quickly, and you don't really have to do much extra for it. You just use your contacts. And that's the kind of thing that's happened with some very big PPE suppliers. So you can see that they keep their sort of margins going, but they just vastly expand their business at very little extra costs to themselves. So they make these huge profits. Now, if you put yourself in the shoes, sorry for the pun, if you put yourself in the shoes of the customer in this case, how would you approach that supplier? You would say, look, I've got this massive order for you. What's the best price you can give me? And you would say, by the way, how much are you paying the Chinese manufacturer for?
Yeah.
Once you knew that, you'd say, oh, well, I'm not going to give you £10 a pair. I might give you £6 or even £5.50. You could bargain some way down. But it seems that the government didn't really do that with these suppliers. It just said, get us with PPE suppliers. It just said, get us what you can. Tell me your price and we'll have it, because they were desperate. And they're really, you know, and we've written a lot about why they were desperate, because they were so badly prepared.
Yeah. When you say they were desperate, it does sound like a reasonable excuse. But actually, if the whole reason that you're desperate is inadequate preparation in the first place, then that kind of mitigates against that.
Well, yeah, but even in their desperation, normally when you're buying goods, any big organization, especially government, you would have a competition. You'd go to all the supplier, potential suppliers, and say,
yeah,
you know, this is what we want. This is how many we want. What kind of price can you do? And they would all have to put in reasonable bids or else they'd be beaten by the competition. But there was no competition. And even the government's own rules said that they should look at the profits companies are making and make sure they're not excessive.
Mm.
And even in this fairly fraught, rushed situation of PPE procurement in sort of April last year, it would have been very simple to ask the suppliers, how much are you paying for this stuff? Or to limit profits on it, say, okay, yeah, we'll pay that price, but only up to the point that 10% margin or something.
Yeah.
There are lots of ways you could do it that are not that complicated.
And that's, in a sense, the whole of what you're saying with profits of doom, is that there are these enormous bubbles of profit which have been allowed to blow up without really much due care or consideration of value for money, which is obviously one of the things that the government is very keen on telling other people about, you know, and hasn't really been exercising in this case.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, as they tell people they can, universal credit claimants, they can handle a £20 a week cut just by working a couple of hours or scrimping a bit more, you know, they're just, it's a completely different approach when it comes to large contracts.
Yeah.
And of course the suppliers, you know, you have to point the finger also at the suppliers. They know there's a national crisis. They know they're making money for old rope. I mean, sometimes it's not far off literally old rope in the case of some of the gowns they were supplying. And they could have reined it in a bit. They could have been a bit more responsible. They didn't need to sort of profiteer.
So one of the interesting things about the way you've been reporting on this is you mentioned that it's now that the company's figures are being published, sometimes for the first time.
Yeah.
And these are publicly available documents that you're looking at. This is not stuff that's leaked or anything like that. Is that right?
Mostly it's the former. But in the case of some of the smaller companies, you know, these weird companies that just popped up that we'd never heard of, companies like Crisp Websites Limited, for example, which traded as Pestfix. It supplied, you know, dog food and stuff like that. And it suddenly started procuring hundreds of millions of pounds worth of PPE in China. You know, that may have been a good thing at the time. We may have needed these companies to use their contacts, get the PPE in. That was very much the atmosphere. But in terms of, was the price right? With companies like that, we don't know, because small companies, they don't have to file accounts showing their income.
Yes, and this is something you wrote about recently. It's companies with balance sheet totals below £5 million and under 50 employees. They don't have to declare their income, their expenses, and their profits at Companies House. They just provide a balance sheet. And when you say balance sheet totals, is that profits at the end of the year after everything's taken into account?
Well, it's what's left in the company, so it's the total value of the assets. So if you whip out the money before the end of the accounting year, you know, you pay dividends to the shareholders or whatever, then, you know, you get under that threshold. So you can make £1 billion in profit. And as long as you took it out before the end of the year, you would be a small company not having to file full accounts.
That feels like a massive oversight.
It is. I think it is, especially in the case of public procurement and procurement in an emergency, where the usual rules, the competition rules, went by the board. And, you know, everybody involved in this work, whether it's business secretary, the National Audit Office, the Public Accounts Committee, they all talk about transparency as the key to ensuring the propriety of this process. Yet, you know, there is no full transparency. A couple of months ago, Dame Margaret Hodge, the Labour MP, who was chair of the Public Accounts Committee, she approached Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng and said, look, you know, why don't we change the rules to make these companies file accounts? It's on his watch. And he said, oh, no, it's too complicated. It would be retroactive, which it wouldn't really. You know, there's just no interest. It would be pretty embarrassing. I mean, what we can see is getting quite embarrassing. Some of the examples we've reported are getting pretty embarrassing.
Let's talk about a couple of those examples. So there was a firm that you wrote about recently called Primer Design. They're based down in Southampton, and they developed a PCR test, which was partly thanks to a collaboration between the NHS and the Wellcome Sanger Institute. Those two bodies provided the gene sequencing that was so useful in developing this PCR test. And then, because they had a PCR test, obviously quite a reliable test, they got contracts from the Department of Health.
Yeah, so they provided test kits, assays, kind of the materials for the tests. You know, and as you say, the technology, the science, the understanding, and the relatively quick development of tests owes a lot to collaborations among all sorts of people in non-profit institutions, academia, pharmaceutical companies. It's quite a team effort, and it was available for companies like Primer Designs, which is part of a European group called Novacyt, to make these tests. And obviously its products were in demand when Matt Hancock belatedly realized that testing people was quite a good idea after all, you know, spring last year. You know, it was a fairly sort of moribund sort of company. It wasn't doing a lot. You know, so its turnover was £5.5 million in 2019 and had been that level for a couple of years, I think. And then last year it shot up to £273 million. So, you know, which is essentially from governments, mostly the UK government. Now, you would have thought, on the same principle we talked about earlier for PPE, you would have thought that buying these materials from a pharmaceutical company, you'd be able to strike a pretty decent deal, given that you wanted so much of it. But it seems not. The profit that the company made at the year end was £178 million. So, you know, about two-thirds of its income, which is astonishing. It's absolutely astonishing.
Those kind of profit margins are not, just for people not in the business world, that's a pretty good profit margin, are we saying?
No, unless you have a completely original invention, then because otherwise competitors come in and they'll do it for, you know, 10%, 5%. You know, I mean, even companies with the most valuable intellectual property, as they call it, you know, inventions, designs, know-how, patents, so on. You know, companies like Apple or Google, which, you know, their margins are 20%. You know, so this is astonishing. You know, you have to ask the question, why did the government, why did the Department of Health let them get away with this? I mean, a lot of reasons why we need to know more about how much they got for doing what. In the US, they've withdrawn the products from sale, the authorization. Yeah, and they were very critical of something that we first picked up in the eye, actually, that Inova was publicising, you know, exaggerated claims about its accuracy. And they actually said you should put them in the trash can. You know, that was a government agency. The US government agencies tend to be a bit more forthright than ours. you know, ours would probably have said something like there are concerns around operability or something. But the Americans said, no, put them in the bin. So, you know, they're not great products. There are also concerns about who's behind this company. You know, this Inova says it's based, well, it is operationally based in California, but it's registered in Las Vegas, Nevada, because there are much better, if you're a company executive, there are much better laws there. You don't have to publish accounts, so we'll never see the profits that Inova makes. You know, there are some pretty friendly laws about liabilities for directors if the company gets into trouble. So, you know, it's not a place you're going to set up a company if you want to be completely open and accountable. You know, you don't go to Las Vegas. You go to Las Vegas for other reasons. Another is the people behind it. You know, it was founded by a chap called Charles Huang, a Hong Kong businessman who set up a not very well-known private equity group called Pasaka Capital, again registered in Las Vegas. You know, and he boasts that his credentials, his main boast about his business credentials on their website is that he, in his words, played a key role in the strategic alliance between China's Brilliance Group and MG Rover Group in the UK in 2002. Now, you know, army readers of 20 years or so will remember that alliance didn't happen. It was one of many dodgy setups that a group businessman called the Phoenix 4 got involved in. Or was it 5? Anyway, a group businessman who were milking MG Rover. And one of the alliances that they set up to earn money from was with this Brilliance Group. Charles Huang was the finance director, but they just disappeared without doing anything. And a government report said they never had any intention getting a serious business with MG Rover. So they were very unreliable at best. Now, if that's your best boast on your CV, you might wonder whether the government should be giving you £3 billion of taxpayers' money. Or at least if we are going to, perhaps we should know a bit more about it.
I'm just wondering, what do you think has to change in the way that procurement is either being handled at the beginning of it or in terms of the declaration of the profits? It sounds like there isn't enough transparency due to various loopholes you can get through. We know that. What else needs to change?
Well, I think you could quite simply say that any company that earned above a certain amount, let's say £5 million from the government on COVID-related contracts, has to publish a full statement of its income and expenditure in relation to those contracts. It's not too difficult, and to have those audited and to publish them. And then you can decide what to do. You might say, well, look, this is ridiculous how much these are made. And some of the figures do look ridiculous. Maybe we should claw some of it back or have a windfall tax. It's not totally unprecedented. Companies, you might remember not so long ago, I mean, it's not in the historical context. It's not unprecedented at all. War times have usually seen excess profits duties to tax both profiteers and those whose business just happened to do extremely well because of the war. And more recently, there have been LIBOR. What do you remember? LIBOR fines for LIBOR manipulation. Those banks who made huge profits by fiddling LIBOR. Well, there's a parallel there. You could say companies that have made huge profits on COVID contracts should give a bit back. And of course, you need to see what happened in order to learn the lessons of it. This was a particular set of circumstances. The rules, the existing rules, went out of the window. The rules requiring competition for public contracts there was a special provision that overrode that. So there was no competition. Mm. And in those circumstances, the only way to ensure that the money was spent properly is to open up the numbers.
Richard Brooks there. Now, we turn to the other end, if you like, of the COVID supply chain, the people who were recruited in large numbers to run various testing services or to run test and trace phone lines in the early days of the pandemic. Solomon Hughes has been writing about those people and talking to a lot of them because some of those workers noticed something extremely strange going on with their employment status. Here's Solomon talking about how those services were initially set up and what transpired afterwards.
The government had gone into a very long chain of subcontracting where they got big contractors to run people working at home on headphones in a kind of call center manner. But the government had contracted big firms like Serco, but they had then subcontracted to another firm who subcontracted to another. So you had this whole mess of subcontracting, which meant that the system was cheap but not efficient. And also, I don't think it wasn't great conditions for people being stuck at home. It wasn't amazing money. Actually, that wasn't the worst money we've come across, but it wasn't amazing money. But it also meant that they didn't really work as a collective. Nobody learned from each other. They just read from scripts. And we kind of continued on that way, and we started looking at test centres as well. But again, we just started getting a lot of staff getting in touch with us. I've had more whistleblowers from the grassroots on this than I've done previously. And I think the reason for that is that in the COVID pandemic, a lot of people have changed jobs. So a lot of people, their job was turned off by the pandemic, and then they saw an ad for a job working, say, in a COVID test centre or on test and trace. And they thought, oh, that's, it's good, I'll be doing something useful. And then they've turned up and they've been unhappy or they found things that are wrong. And so there's lots of new starters. And what you find with whistleblowers is generally if someone's been in the job a long time, they don't blow the whistle because they depend on the salary, they're used to working there, they've had to accept something wrong or they've made a deal with it. So you often get whistleblowers who either have just started or are retiring. Oddly enough is another one. That's not been the case so much here. But because a whole new tranche of people have started coming into these new jobs, they've been, often young people I've found, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, have started these jobs. And they've come in and they said, what? This isn't right. And then they've tried to do something and it hasn't worked. And then they've got in touch with us.
And one of the really interesting things that you've been reporting on recently is this term MUCs, which I had never heard before it cropped up in the pages of Private Eye a couple of months ago, I think. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
Yeah, mini umbrella companies mucking about. Oddly enough, we sort of had covered this already a while back, I think maybe a year or so back, because at the other end, where we were looking into Companies House and all these obviously fakey looking companies there, and we had done a piece about this was like a dubious, all these fakey companies as some kind of weird tax avoidance scam that was pretty huge. And it was actually Richard Brooks, who has a very strong specialism on corporate structures, who was looking into all these dodgy-looking, weird, small, mini-companies that appeared on Companies House, but in an unregulated fashion. And then the story went away. And then the story came back, because the people who worked on one of the COVID testing centres, you know, the people in the hi-vis who take you through and, you know, take your test and bottle it up and get it sent off, all these people got in touch and they said, this is just so bizarre. But there's quite a few whistleblowers, but one was particularly helpful and really put it together for us. They said, well, I'm working on a COVID test centre, and I thought I was working for G4S, but then it turned out I wasn't recruited by G4S. I was recruited by another smaller temp company called HR Go. And then they said, but when their payslips turned up, it didn't say HR Go, it didn't say G4S, it had all these ludicrous companies. They all had different companies with absurd names, Androsa Snake, Phthalamon, but a lot, you know, really ludicrous names. And this person, we didn't even have to do this. The worker had done this, and they often were controlled by young directors based in the Philippines, fake companies. And so what that was, and again, the whistleblower had worked this out, was it what's called the mini umbrella company fraud, where you employ lots of people through what are called mini umbrella companies. So each company employs only half a dozen people, even though they're pretty fakey. And it means that all these tiny companies can claim an allowance from HMRC for handling tax. So they don't pay as much national insurance or tax. They're given a grant, which all big employers are. Every employer is given a grant for handling the tax of their staff. But if you divide it into lots of little companies, you can get more grant.
So who is it actually who is carrying out this mini umbrella fraud? It's not the parent company. It's not the G4S, presumably. Is it one of the subcontracting firms that we think is responsible for this?
Well, one of the subcontracting firms is responsible, but they in turn have probably passed it to an unnamed and unknown third agent, and the agent puts together the package. Typically, an agent will put together a package. They'll approach a temp agency and say, I will do your payroll for free, but I will do it in this way. They don't necessarily tell them, but they'll do their payroll for free, or even pay them a bonus for each employee they do the payroll for. And when they do the payroll, they then set up this complex fraud. They make a bit of money from it, some of which they either pass on to the subcontractors and ultimately the big company by doing the work more cheaply, or even, like I say, sometimes paying a small bonus per employee. I mean, obviously, if you had any sense or morals, if somebody approached you and said, I'll do your payroll for free or even pay you a bonus per each member of staff, you'd think, well, that doesn't sound right. And HMRC send out regular warnings saying, watch out for the mini umbrella company fraud. And they explain these are the signs. Directors based abroad, young directors based abroad, newly founded companies that haven't filed accounts, multiple companies handling staff at one location. You know, HMRC warn, and they say it's a crime. They say they've actually made some arrests. They're not really aggressive enough about dealing with this, but they do a bit. What was striking about this was that the member of staff, the worker who got in touch with us, actually explained the whole package. I just had to go through and correct it. And then when I went to the two companies involved, HR Go, in theory, the direct employer, just gave a lot of legal verbiage and said they thought it was all right. G4S just said, we're looking into it, we're not sure it's our responsibility, and really wouldn't respond. Ultimately, they gave in and said, we're stopping it. So actually, G4S sacked HR Go and said, we're stopping it. They finally gave in, but it took some time. But what was striking was that these two or three employees had worked this out, £10 an hour workers in high-vis jackets on a temp contract had worked out this fraud, and G4S a multinational, a security company. It's not just a temp case, it's a security company that employs police. They claim to employ ex-intelligence service people with a massive compliance department, could not spot it, and took ages, when we did make it clear to them, to do anything about it.
It's so interesting, these many umbrella companies, and I'm sure there will be more examples of it coming up soon. One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about, in terms of the people who have been working at the really sharp end of COVID, is the stories that you've been writing about statutory sick pay, and about how a lot of the workers have ended up without proper sick pay, despite working maybe catering, maybe cleaning in hospitals. So can you tell us a bit more about this?
It's something that came up through looking at the contracts for various, specifically COVID jobs. And I just thought, we know one of the injustices that's been, or inequalities that's been highlighted by the pandemic, is sick pay. Actually, most employers, around 6 in 10 employers in this country, pay what's called occupational sick pay. That means if you're off work, you get your full wage. That's it. I mean, sometimes there are limitations. They might say you're only allowed to get 2 weeks of sick pay, or 6 months of sick pay, or 6 months full, 6 months half. Or they might say if you take more than a week, sick pay will investigate you. You know, there are limits to it. But basically, if you're off sick, for most employers, you're paid your full wage. But about a quarter of employers, and this is a growing problem, you know, because of really the casualisation of labour, a quarter of employers don't pay any sick pay, apart from statutory sick pay, which is the legal minimum. But the legal minimum in this country, I mean, actually, it's a thing of labour rights in this country. We have lots of not bad workplace-level agreements or employer-level agreements, but our legal minima are often quite low. And statutory sick pay is £130 a week, which even Matt Hancock, he was challenged very directly by the head of the TUC early in the pandemic, said he couldn't live on. So because of that, it means that in some cases people are driven back to, or in the early part of the pandemic, people were driven back to work when they were sick. You know, they wouldn't take time off sick, which is obviously a nightmare. If you feel a sore throat in this situation, don't be going to work. And we found subcontractors, the subcontracting in health and for COVID that did it. So, for example, there's a big firm called Mighty, and we had a particular hospital where they had cut it and then reinstated it and cut it. We also found that Mighty had the contract to run the SIS service where when you fly in, you're supposed to be rung up at home to check yourself isolating. And I was like, well, do they have sick pay? They said, no, sorry, it didn't work out. They don't. They're on the statutory sick pay. Typically, the people on the testing sites don't have sick pay either. Now, I mean, that was a kind of interesting thing, because we approached DHSC and said, well, do they have sick pay? And Mighty had said to us, well, we always talk to the employer and suggest they should pay occupational, the higher level of sick pay. And so I asked the Department of Health, I said, oh, did that happen? Did Mighty ask you about occupational sick pay for staff on test sites? And they said, no, they didn't, but it doesn't matter, because staff on test sites do have occupational sick pay, i.e. if they're off sick, they would get full pay, which didn't sound right. The people who worked on the sites hadn't said that to me. So I went back to them. I said, are you sure? Can I see the bits of the contract that say that? And they sent the bits of the contract, and they don't have occupational sick pay. What they have is a special form of sick pay which only covers COVID. So if you're on a test site, because of what DHSC's decision... Now, I mean, initially, even this wasn't the case, but now they've altered the contract. So if you're on a test site and you say, I've been tested positive for COVID, they'll say, go home and we will pay you. Or if you say, test and trace have told me to isolate, they'll say, go home and we will pay you. They recognise it would be ridiculous to not pay people at COVID test sites if they had COVID. But if you have anything else, if you've got flu, diarrhoea, you know, you've broken your leg, whatever, any other form of sickness, you're back on statutory sick pay, mate. Sorry, you're on £130 a week. We can't help you. Which is interesting is the wrong word. Disgusting, actually, is the right word. But it's interesting, because you just think the Department of Health puts it in the contract. I mean, all the contractors, as far as I can tell, as my understanding is, Sodexo, Mighty, G4S, go along with it. They haven't really, as they claimed, I don't think, really pressed for it. They haven't been, the subcontractors haven't been good employers, but the DHSC have been worse. They're the Department of Health. It does say health is in their name, and they've said, we've written in a contract that you shouldn't pay occupational sick pay, unless in the case of COVID. You know, so that's a model employer, but it's the model is bad. That's the government levelling down, in fact. They're saying, we look to the 6 in 10 employers who pay occupational sick pay, and we thought, oh, you're idiots. We prefer the quarter that don't pay any and rely apart from the statutory minimum.
So that's the sick pay area, but I presume at least these people are being paid properly in their normal wage.
Well, oddly enough, shortly after we raised the mini umbrella company issue, you know, finally G4S agreed that was wrong and said they stopped it, and they did stop it. Another member of staff on their sites got in touch and said, well, they have stopped it. It took a while. But immediately after they stopped it, we all had our basic pay cut. We went from £10 an hour to £9.50 an hour. So the second, we're still here, but we're earning less. I said, oh, no, that's not very good. He's like, no, it's not. It didn't seem like much of a reward. In fairness, it wasn't just them being punished. Actually, it looks like it was a DHS, a Department of Health decision, because other people got in touch from different companies and they said, yeah, we got our pay cut as well. We were on £10 an hour basic and we went to £9.50 an hour. And in the case of Sodexo, a member of staff at Sodexo got in touch and they said, well, it's really bad here, because Sodexo actually managed to expand the number. Sodexo is a French catering giant, so exactly the kind of people you want to be running health sites, but there you go. So Sodexo took over, increased the amount of sites they run, and their boss said he was incredibly proud of all the hard work they'd done, but that led to a pay cut from £10 to £9.50 an hour. And in fact, not only that, but the people who got in touch with us, they were at one particular site. I mean, the pay cut is across all sites, hundreds and hundreds of sites, but one particular site, Welling Garden City, they said, well, not only has our pay been cut, but we've been moved to Sodexo from a different contractor, and we're not being paid at all. We haven't been paid for weeks. So there's a happy ending in a way, in that we got in touch with Sodexo and they were sort of embarrassed and said they had sorted out the money, and so they did get their money. So the staff got their lower rate there, but at least they got paid. But I looked into this, and it's extraordinary, actually. Sodexo's UK turnover is about 1.2 billion. They're not small. 1.2 billion is their annual turnover just in the UK, as far as I could see from their books. But Sodexo's test centre contracts are worth 221 million. That's nearly a fifth of their entire UK turnover is coming from test centres. I mean, that's a lot of money, 221 million, but it's not filtering down. The staff are getting a pay cut. Both G4S and Sodexo told me that, oh no, we're happy because our staff is at least being paid the real living wage. The real living wage is a kind of a charity sets like a livable amount. But they're using the real living wage as a way of cutting pay. So they're saying, well, we're paying above it, so well, let's cut down to it. And again, it's a levelling up, levelling down question. I was at the Conservative conference and Boris Johnson said, oh, Labour wants to level down, we want to level up. Well, oddly enough, the Department of Health is exactly levelling down instead of levelling up.
Solomon Hughes there. Thanks to him and to Richard Brooks for their contributions. If you would like to level up your own life, then why not go to private-i.co.uk and subscribe to the magazine. It is available on all good newsstands, but why take the risk with the shortages as they are? You never know when it's going to hit newsprint. Subscribe now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Page 94. We will be back again next month with another one. It's been produced, as always, by Matt Hill, and we'll see you then. Goodbye.